Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. There are probably few institutions that place as much importance on keeping your emotions under control as the military. And you could make the argument that for a soldier, keeping your emotions in check is something that is very important, maybe even vital, particularly when you're dealing with combat situations. However, there are costs that are associated with that. In this hour of the show, we will consider the costs of being stoic. And our guest for the program is Nancy Sherman. She's a professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. And among the things that she's interested in are military ethics. She served as the very first distinguished chair of ethics at the U.S. Naval Academy. This was from 1997 until 1999. She is also a fellow of the Kennedy Institute of Ethics. She has also taught at Yale, where she was associate professor. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll talk a bit about military ethics and about this whole business of stoicism in the military. And this, by the way, is the subject of a book that she authored that you might want to take a look at. Whether you are someone who is interested in military science or philosophy or both, and the title of her book is Stoic Warriors, The Ancient Philosophy Behind the Military Mind. This book is published by the Oxford University Press and came out in 2005. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome. We welcome folks into the conversation. The only thing that we ask of callers is to just that people are brief as they can be so that we can keep moving and accommodate as many different people as possible. But certainly, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Sherman, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I think probably if we just went out on the street and we stopped people and we said to them, if we said someone was stoic or someone was being stoic, what do we mean by that? And I expect that then, you know, in the common way that we use that word, they would say, well, that means that it's somebody who is not showing their emotions. Some people might even say that someone who doesn't have emotions. And particularly it means somebody who is, say, cool or not emotional when things are really bad. So that's kind of that's the way I would define it. And I think a lot of people would.
That's right. Yeah.
And so that's pretty much, as we commonly use it, that's what we're talking about.
That's right. A kind of sense. To be stoic is, as my naval midshipman used to say, to suck it up.
Yeah, that is
the British would say, stiff upper lip.
And that is, I like the fact that in the preface to the book, that is indeed the very first line, this book is about sucking it up.
That's right, and that is the mantra in the military, not just the academies, but when you are in boot camp, when you deploy, and when you come home. And I think the real issue, as you say, is the cost. It's a blessing and a curse. A blessing to tough it out, and a curse to be stuck with toughing it out too long and too hard. Mm.
And we should say, obviously, it's not just the mantra of the military. I mean, there certainly
not at all.
Are other people who would say that would be their motto too. So it's not, don't want to just say, like, lay this on the military and say,
not at all.
A military thing.
No, it's a style and an attitude to life, and particularly to tough times, whether it be things that you bring on yourself or accidents that happen or tragedies you get stuck with or the vicissitudes, the ups and downs of life, losses, deaths, stock market crash, the banks going down under now, or what military people face with the carnage and death and also just not having much control. So in a way, it's a way of controlling. It's a way of seeking control because it's a way of putting a circle around what you can control. And the Stoics, and now I'm thinking about philosophers 2nd century before the Common Era to 2nd century after the Common Era, so More popular figures like Seneca, the Roman orator and advisor to Nero, but Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, and less common figures like one of the many Zenos in the ancient world, they would argue it's a way of getting rid of the kinds of attitudes and emotions that get you into trouble, that lead to perturbation and disturbance and emotional upheaval. And if you can believe that the things outside of your control are really not part of your happiness, then you are on the way to defining a narrower form of happiness that is more insulated, you know, and that gives you greater inoculation.
So this you've done anticipated where I was going next, and that is to make some connection between, or ask, what is the connection between the common way that we use the word Stoic and this school of philosophy that does indeed go back to the Romans and the Greeks,
right.
Stoicism.
So Stoicism, and to be Stoic is in the vernacular, a philosophical term in the vernacular more than being Aristotelian or Platonic or Cartesian has its fair play in our language. And part of what is in our contemporary parlance really is in the ancient mode as well, or the ancient texts. Part of my concern and the kind of joy of writing Stoic Warriors was to see what the ancient roots were, both not just philosophically and militarily, but psychologically. So it's a book really that has a psychological facet to it. And it turned out when I did my research that the ancient Stoic world was a little more complex. Some things were very similar. That Stoicism became a popular public philosophy during the Roman times. There were court philosophers that the rich and famous had, like Nero and others. And in part, it was a way to deal with the decorum and the requirements of public life and of grieving appropriately, being afraid appropriately, losing and mourning appropriately. But also, it was sort of had a deeper philosophical element and was revising what we mean by happiness, very revisionist. Hmm. Someone like Aristotle would say happiness is not just what you yourself can do in terms of your virtue and reason, and your effort, but some good fortune, good luck, and good friends, a modicum of prosperity, good health. Aristotle goes maybe too far, a little beauty would help. not being solitary or childless, or if you do have children, having them turn out well. The Stoics say, boy, this puts happiness in the hands of fate, or at least a lot of luck. So let's have a more autonomous, kind of self-sufficient notion of happiness, and let's make happiness only what we can control in terms of virtue and reason, and that means getting rid of the emotions that cause upheaval and bring on emotions that come fast and furious and you can't turn off, and maybe some emotions are okay, but much more rational ones, more studied, more cultivated. So we retain some of it, you know, the sense of detachment that you mentioned earlier, that's certainly ancient. Maybe in psychological talk now, we call it a kind of dissociation. We're good at dissociating, good at compartmentalizing. You can take it too far. And the Stoics themselves took it too far. Seneca was wrestling in his work with getting it, the moderate notion right.
I think probably my first reading very much about Stoicism, and I know just enough to make me dangerous now at this point. but I guess one of the things that really strikes me about this is how much to me it sounds like Buddhism.
Yes, and I mentioned this a little bit in the book. Mm-hmm. Buddhism, the Eastern religion and philosophy, is also about detaching, about letting go. And for a very similar kind of reason, letting go so that you can be more in control of your happiness and less subject to all the turmoil and ebb and flow that's in life. And they both believe in a kind of philosophy. There's a sense of set of beliefs that you, especially if you study Buddhism, that you should come to believe that there are certain negative emotions and that selflessness, meaning your narcissism or ego, doesn't count for much, out there in the world, and that there's a sense of impermanence. You know, the making these Buddhist monks making these amazing sand mandalas and other kinds of structures, and then blowing them away afterwards. Stoicism doesn't share all of that. It shares the idea that your happiness could be less subject to the flux of the world, but it believes in the self in an important way. It believes in reason, and it's almost, you know, like think about what you can do, and what it's a can-do philosophy. Mm-hmm. I don't think Buddhism is quite that way. Buddhism says, "Let watch all the thoughts that go in your head and let them go." And Stoicism says, "Be a philosopher. Row the oars of dialectic, hard, discursive, ordinary philosophy. Come to believe different things about the world, appraise the world differently, and you'll have a more controlled kind of happiness." Yeah. So the end point's similar, but the means are different.
It's more. Do you think it's correct to say that Stoicism is a humanistic
philosophy? To some degree, but also very much very engaged with reason and busy with reason. From my understanding of Buddhism and with having close friends that are Buddhists and their meditative practices, it's very much about getting rid of the busyness of reason and all the preoccupation with reasoning, at least in meditation, whereas meditation for the Stoics, and they use that same term, is therapeia. It's a therapy of... That's the Greek term, therapy. It's a therapy where you engage in reason. You change your beliefs about the world, that your reason matters and all the things outside you are of no real merit or worth, and that will help you have a different set of emotions recalibrated to different kinds of attachments that are less sticky and less troubling.
I guess to me it seems that a fundamental point here of Stoicism is something like we can't control what the world throws at us, but we can control how we react to it.
Very much so. Very much about the attitude you bring to the world. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a POW or you're in a hospital bed or you've just lost your child. And you can control, they say, getting ready for these things. So just as the military is very much about training and discipline and attitude, so too the Stoics believe, anticipate, pre-rehearse, they say. Say every morning when you say goodbye to your child at the school bus, so to speak, I always knew my child was mortal, so that should something happen at the end of the day, you've tried to indoctrinate yourself with that expectation. Hmm. Tough medicine, I think.
So you, and one of the things that you said was from your experience teaching at the Naval Academy and your experience dealing with military people, career military people, that they, you found that they were powerfully and understand, and now as you've talked some about what it's about, understandably so, were powerfully drawn to Stoicism.
Yes, it's amazing. And I continue to do work in this area and working on a new book called The War Within that may be out in a year or so with Norton Press. The more I interview people, and for the new book I've interviewed about 35, and same for Stoic warriors, there are individuals who not only sort of by osmosis take in the Stoic military culture as a warrior ethos, but they study it. So Jim Stockdale was, as many of us remember, an admiral who at the time was a naval captain in Vietnam when he was shot down. And he became the senior POW in the Hanoi Hilton in the POW camp that McCain was also in, John McCain was in. And he had been a student at Stanford as a graduate student after leaving the Naval Academy, tried out international relations, but philosophy is what stuck, and was handed Epictetus's handbook, a small book, part of Epictetus's work, and had memorized it. And when he was shot down, he said, "I'm leaving behind the world of technology and entering the world of Epictetus." And he practiced it. He knew what he could control and what he couldn't control, and he was not going to give an inch to the interrogators and to the torturers, and he would try to put a perimeter around himself and use it as a chain of command method as well. Similarly, more recently, I've talked to folks that are serving in Iraq as heads of medical facilities, psychiatric, psychological mental health care units who believe in stoic resilience. And they read Marcus Aurelius, the great military leader and philosopher who wrote Meditations on the Shores of the Danube during the invasions there. And he reads Epictetus, and he tries to teach it, that this is a warrior cult. It's a warrior ethos. And my concern is that it can protect, but it can protect too far. Hmm. It can fail to remember, use the word humanitarian or humanistic, it can fail to remember that we have limits to being bulletproof. And to come home from war, and as one of my soldiers I interviewed said, I've sucked it up for 23 years and I can't do it anymore. He has to learn how to feel again after, and feel on his own terms, and not just when it's at the moment it's okay, as war allows you. War doesn't often allow you many times to feel and breathe the damage of war.
Let me just take a moment here to introduce again our guest for this hour, Nancy Sherman. She's professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. She served as distinguished chair of ethics at the U.S. Naval Academy from 1997 until 1999. In fact, was the first person to hold that post. She's also fellow of the Kennedy Institute of Ethics, and before going to Georgetown, she taught at Yale. She is interested in a number of topics in philosophy, and one of the things that she's interested in is military ethics. The subject here, in part, that we're talking about is the subject of a book that she wrote and was published a couple of years ago. The title of her book is Stoic Warriors, The Ancient Philosophy Behind the Military Mind. It's published by the Oxford University Press and does indeed explore some of the ideas of the Stoics, these philosophers of ancient Greece and Rome, but also it talks about just how much resonance there is for people today, particularly in the military, how it is they are drawn to the Stoics, and how perhaps by looking at these Stoic philosophers and using that lens, in a sense, to you can also maybe get a better understanding of the challenges and the stresses and the pressures that come to bear on people in the military. And questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in how the people that you have talked to think about this issue of managing emotions in the military, because I'm sure that there are people who would say, look, there's no room for it. There's no time for it. You certainly can't, you know, you got to keep your emotions locked away somewhere when you're on the battlefield, because those things just get in the way. So then the question is, well, okay, if we're, how then do we deal with them? Do we, in some sort of way, in some sort of institutional way, do we try to deal with them? And when and where and how? It seems to me that these are all very, very difficult questions.
They are. It's thought often that you have to defer, especially grief, on the battlefield, and in a sense compartmentalize, leave behind feelings for family, worries about what's happening at home with your children, and whether indeed you'll come home, because they will get in the way of the mission. We now know, especially in the light of Vietnam, that it's devastating to defer for too long grief, that we need to have time for collective grieving, funerals near the time of the death, and we need to make time to feel human again. You got to also understand that one of the emotions that's not deferred or really put too far behind one's mind is camaraderie, real kind of love for fellow soldiers. That is the family. Soldiers are socialized. When I say soldiers, I mean airmen, sailors, Marines, men and women. Soldiers are socialized with a new family that they depend on and that will be there for them if they go down, and vice versa. So that feeling's there. That's going to mean with that attachment, there's going to be very intense feelings about loss. Now, you got to be able to move on. You got to be able to carry on with the mission. But there has to be some grieving time near the time of loss. And so in the current war, if you remember, there were some Chinooks that went down very early, I think, in Afghanistan. And a day or two later, there were division-wide funerals because commanders really understood. And in the current war, we have critical debriefing areas, you might say. There are medical teams with psychologists and social workers that are set up right near the areas of deployment to be able to handle critical events, they call it. And chaplains, psychologists, social workers sometimes go out with troops to be there when and if there are accidents happening. They're very near at hand. They try to sell the product of resilience and of the importance of social and psychological work beforehand and afterhand. So there are attempts to break the stigma that comes with talking about your feelings, and also also to break the mystique that there's no time. There's got to be some time, but it isn't always found, and I think it takes a wise military leader to know exactly when is the appropriate moment, but it can't be deferred for too long.
Let's talk with someone here. We have a caller who'd like to join the conversation, someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. I didn't hear all of what you said, so you might have covered this in a different way, but I did hear you talking when you compared Stoic meditation and Buddhist meditation, and I just, the phrase you used was Buddhist meditation described as getting rid of thoughts, and I just wanted to clarify that is not Buddhist meditation. Buddhist meditation is allowing thoughts to come and go, not to get rid of them, because if you fight against something, you just create more energy and attachment. And since the attachment is always the issue, it's important to make that distinction. It's subtle but very important. But I also want to go to a second point, which is, I think, more apropos of your discussion. Friend of mine, or a Dharma brother, if we call it that, taught meditation at the U.S. Air Force Academy to a group of Buddhist cadets there that regularly practice Buddhism there. Now, I don't know very much about it, and there's obviously issues that are to be explored about how one can practice Buddhism and be a cadet or a military person, and that's something that needs to be clarified and dealt with, and it has been throughout the history of Buddhism. But I find it interesting. I was quite surprised that there is this ongoing group. This was at the Air Force Academy, but I'm also exploring this, found that there are groups at other academies who are doing Buddhist meditation. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, thank you very much. You're quite right. Buddhist meditation is not really getting rid of, letting them go would be a better phrase, watching them come in and not engaging them discursively. And Stoicism is very much about engaging discursively and very moralistic, chastising, exhorting yourself as much as you can. So it's very much pull your socks up kind of philosophy. And that is the tone or the difference I meant to really emphasize. I know of an Army colonel who himself, while in training and as a ranger throughout his career, was very engaged in studying Buddhism and practicing Buddhism as a way of learning some resilience and a kind of calming method. So I'm not surprised at all about what you say about the Air Force Academy, and I would be very I would not be surprised either to learn that there are other groups at other academies and in ROTC programs and ROTC programs where Buddhism is an attractive meditation style, as well as kind of a way of learning how to deal with stress.
Yeah, I've also been told, but can't say much about it, that there's also a Buddhist meditation group at the Pentagon.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, there are many different strands of forms of resilience and forms of dealing with stress, as well as experimental methods, trying to understand just what is in the serum of those that are able to endure with some kind of calm and without too much psychological aftermath, really horrendous circumstances. So So that's being actively explored as well.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other comments or questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. This is a question it perhaps might be better directed at a psychologist, but I'm sure that
it's... I should also say I have psychoanalytic training. So.
Oh, well, in that case, perfecto. And here's the question. I think that we know that we have to believe that as long as human beings have been involved in combat, people have experienced combat-related stress. Over time, we have had different names for it, and probably now the thing that we talk about most is post-traumatic stress disorder, which can be the result of many different kinds of profound stress, not just combat, but that's certainly one of them. But it seems that even now, as much as we are talking about this, and it's something that the military is trying to address, that we still seem to be in some respect in denial about how profound it is and how many people are affected.
I think that's absolutely right. The studies vary, but Walter Reed Research Institute, at the beginning of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, did an exit survey, and they estimated about one-third were coming home with some range of emotional and mental problems based on exit surveys that aren't always as reliable, nor are soldiers particularly interested in filling them out. These, I think, were interesting as they were done a little later, possibly 2-3 months later. But we certainly know that that post-traumatic stress disorder is a spectrum sort of disease. It's like being a little overweight or a lot overweight. You can fall on different places on the spectrum. And that you can manifest some of the clusters of the symptoms of the disease without having the disease full blown. It's also probably not well thought of as a disease or a disorder. We don't talk about amputations or limb loss in terms of a disorder. So the stigma that attaches and the denial that you mention is in part nomenclature. We might do well to come up with a different way of describing the phenomenon. The phenomenon is real, and as I say, there's agreement in clustering the symptoms around a sense of kind of repetitive flashbacks or nightmares that are they're not really kind of remembering, but almost a reliving, a reenactment. You're there then, as some of the folks I talk to describe it. I'm back there. I'm drifting right there. It's sensory imprinted, less verbally imprinted than sensory imprinted, and so it's encoded in a very different way and often not easily connected to language and words, but they're visually and sensorily and smell correlated. Also in terms, another set of symptoms have to do with numbing and avoidance, just don't feel anything about what happened. It's a kind of severe dissociation from what happened, and also then very physiological symptoms of hyperarousal, hypervigilance, fast heartbeat. One of the persons I interviewed, who's a psychologist himself now at McLean Hospital, Harvard's mental teaching psychiatric teaching hospital, and in the reserve, said he was in a meeting at McLean. There was a lot of construction going on, and he noticed his pulse jumped, but his voice stayed calm, and everything else about him was calm, but inside he was back in Iraq. And so it was a very detached kind of isolated symptom where his body took over, his autonomic system took over. He said, I learned a lot about the autonomic nervous system in that episode. And he's since now less reactive to that kind of conditioned response. People have this, suffer from it, and there's still a lot of denial. And this is part of the Stoic myth and the warrior ethos. You're supposed to be bulletproof. You're supposed to come home unwounded from war. You went a warrior, and you come home a warrior, all intact. and able to deploy again. Many are dying to deploy again and want to serve again, and they're not the same. And it is not at all a statement about moral weakness or moral failure, though it's often internalized as such, a kind of guilt or shame. And in some cases, we know from the Walter Reed fiasco, and this has played out in other hospitals, military hospitals around the country, that there aren't always empathetic administrative staff who really want to hear about the woes of those that come home from war, not the same. And I interviewed one case, as sad as can be, where his senior officer, a psychiatrist, refused to accept that he had post-traumatic stress disorder and said, if you want to challenge this, and if the report comes back negative from a second opinion, I will I will demote you. You know, and so he was threatened with loss of honor, and that was very shaming to him. So we there's a lot we need to do to get over the stigma, and the military is aware of it, but not all the practitioners are aware of it, and often the most senior officers are the least likely to self-refer because it is a killer for your career. And we need to make the message clear that it no longer reflects poorly on your career and on your retirement package and on your previous service. That it is a natural response to overwhelming conditions where helplessness is one of the things that you feel when you can't control the environment, when you're going to see an IED, when you're going to be up against loss.
You know, I've had the opportunity on a couple of occasions here on the show to talk with Jonathan Shea.
Yes, and he's a friend, and he's done important work in this area.
And he is quite well known for having worked with soldiers suffering the after effects of combat, and has written now two books about it.
Achilles in Vietnam, Achilles, and Odysseus.
That's right. And
in America.
And those are books that they have really resonated, particularly, I think, with people in the military. I'm sure that among the many people who have read these books, there are a lot of soldiers who have read them. And what, you know, one of the things that he writes about is that it is one of the challenges, if you want to look at it in that way, that military faces when they're bringing people in and they're training them to be soldiers and to go into combat, is to get them to the point where they could kill somebody. Which is not a natural for most people. Fortunately, this is not a natural thing. It's not easy. And he observes in these books is that over time, that the military has actually been more successful at getting people to the point where they can actually do it, where they can actually pull the trigger.
That's right. There's a repugnance to kill. It's some of those that I've interviewed say it feels unnatural, and to some they think of it in terms of thou shalt not kill as a kind of murder. Ethically speaking, killing in self-defense in a just war where there's just conduct, a lot of ifs, is not murder. It is a kind of self-defense. But nonetheless, holding a gun, or the case of my uncle, who was a World War II soldier, a bayonet in Okinawa, is repugnant until you start doing it. And then the horrible thing for many that causes as much distress and despair is that there is an adrenaline rush, that they enjoy doing it. The first time is horrific, and the second and third time there's actually some kind of, sometimes, not always, a thrill in the revenge. So part of what I worry about in my work is not just overcoming the repugnance to kill, which we've learned how to do well almost through simulated techniques of inoculation, mm-hmm. and rehearsal, but also understanding those complex motions of shame, of going back to civilian life and not being able to tell anyone what you did, of reintegrating yourself, your person as a killer and as a peaceful mother, sister, parent. Those are very difficult transitions, and it's not seamless.
Yeah.
And we need to understand better that reintegration is a lifelong project.
And I hope people who are listening here are not going to get the wrong idea. We're not saying that soldiers are evil. We're not saying they're murderers. We're not saying they're killers. We're not saying they're terrible people. What I'm at least suggesting is that, well, you know, killing might indeed be part of the job. This might be self-defense, and one would hope that that's what it is. But, you know, that's war. Okay, so that goes with it. And I guess the question that we're raising here is, what are the consequences of being able to get a person to the point where he or she can do that? And then once you do, well, then, you know, what...
Leave it behind.
What follows.
That's right. Very few come home from war as killers. We know that. But what they do come home from war with is a set of very mixed and confused emotions about what they did, about who they are, about whether a part of them is somehow tainted, and whether this is a part of themselves that they can talk about with their family. And my view, and I know it's Jonathan Shay's as well, is that we need to be much more open as a society about understanding those conflicting emotions and about the role switches we ask young men and women and older men and women to make. So these are our children. These are our brothers and sisters, and they come home with very confused, and I don't mean that they're confused in the sense of naive. These are powerful, powerful emotions and thoughts, and there needs to be a lot more public understanding and empathy for that transition.
Just very quickly here, we have about 10 minutes. I want to mention once again our guest is Nancy Sherman. She's professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. She's served as a consultant to the U.S. Navy and Naval Academy. She was the first distinguished chair of ethics at the U.S. Naval Academy from 1997 until 1999. She's also a fellow of the Kennedy Institute of Ethics and, among other things, is interested in military ethics. That is the subject that we're trying to talk about here, about some of what you will find in a book that she authored and was published a couple of years ago, titled Stoic Warriors, The Ancient Philosophy Behind the Military Mind, published by the Oxford University Press. Just something that I wonder, when you were in the classroom or in times when you've talked about these things with military people, but particularly I guess I'm thinking in the classroom as you're working with people before they're going to go out and possibly be in combat. How do you engage them in thinking about or talking about where they will be when they're at that point that they are on the battlefield and they're having to make some decisions about, do I use deadly force or not? And is that something that you can prepare someone for? Or is that something that it's simply there's just is no way to know what that's like until you're there?
Well, the training of let's now talk about the Army, for example, my experience talking with folks at Georgetown at the ROTC program, they're out doing drills a lot. A lot of them have to do with very complicated scenarios and decision making, and these are the young officers that are actually going to be at 22, you know, more like 24, leading often men and women far older than themselves, less educated, but with lots more combat experience. But these are the people that are going to have to try to also restrain unnecessary force and make sure, as one young man said to me, who's now sort of training in infantry, he said, Haditha had just occurred, and the kind of quick and reckless reaction to killing of comrades with a lot of response and payback. I want to make sure when my soldiers go out and case a house and see if the bombing came from that house, that they don't go crazy. So what we talk about often in dealing with military ethics is the restraint, the responsibility of commanding units where there is a lot of deadly force, understanding revenge. Revenge will be there. It is an emotion that may be ugly, and the Stoics are fascinating here. You know, they would like us to absolutely rid ourselves of any sense of anger or revenge, only fight on principle. And I think in part that's right. You fight for a cause that you believe in, but often soldiers, especially as war goes south and doesn't seem the causes shift, they don't really know what the cause is or they don't fully embrace it. They fight for each other. And when they fight for each other and they see horrible things happen without really in the fog of war, the temptation is to get trigger happy. And so if anything, insofar as I've been involved more in the training of officers than in just in, you know, the enlisted, a lot of what goes on is restraint and making sure that procedures are followed and that there's enough understanding and that they're out there almost being peacekeepers. You know, they're trying to deal with locals. They're dealing with a lot of sectarian violence. They're trying to figure out who knows something about the area, what the customs are like, who's got the truth on the story, what actually happened. As once a Marine officer actually told me, you know, he saw someone getting very hot when he said, you know, we're going to respect these civilians. We're not going to have assumptions that they're the bad guys. He saw someone lift his third finger, and he immediately had that guy shadowed by another Marine who he thought was cooler-headed. Hmm. So a lot of it is, you know, you got people who are very angry in very stressed circumstances out there for a long time on multiple deployments. It is hard, hard work. A young guy named Robert Kislow said to me, 19 months in Walter Reed, lost his leg, titanium arm, shot in the head and back in a 12-hour fight in Afghanistan. He was a sniper, and he got the guy that was trying to kill him and killed his buddies. He said, no one ever prepared me for the after life of war. Nothing could prepare me. And he wanted to be a soldier since he was 5.
We have a couple of other callers here. Let's get them in the time that remains. Next, we'll talk with someone here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello?
Hi. I couldn't listen to all of what you were saying, but I wanted to share an image from the movie No End in Sight.
I don't know that movie.
It's a documentary that was playing recently in theaters, like within a month or so ago. May still be out. It's a documentary interviewing Bush insiders and military insiders.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't
know. About the Iraq War. And one of the things that they got hold of was a home video done by a mercenary group. I don't know who it was. It was the private contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a happy little music going along, and they were videoing shooting down cars, civilian cars,
mm-hmm.
that were behind them. And you saw the cars go off the road and crash, and it was like a video game.
Well, this is a real concern we've been seeing in the news, obviously, a lot about military contractors. That's a whole other subject about how uniformed United States service men and women fight side by side with military contractors. We know they are. We know it doesn't always work. I know personally of a case that now has been nationally covered, Colonel Ted West using a military ethicist at West Point, a philosopher, PhD from Emory, went to serve under Petraeus about 2-3 years ago in Baghdad, worked with contractors and military police, and saw things that were really quite unsavory. And he committed suicide, leaving a long note behind that said he was sullied. His honor comes first, and his honor was sullied. Contractors, as well as others, rev up for war in quite ways we would find quite despicable. They've kind of got to inoculate themselves, and sometimes in ways that turn on the combat button but leave out the ethics. And the challenge is enormous on the shoulders of young officers who are leading units of 20 in battle. To fight ethically. You know, we can't even get into what counts as a just conduct, and we can't get into the question, which is a troubling one, is can you fight just with just conduct if the cause isn't just, or you don't believe the cause is just? So these are very, you know, philosophical problems, but they are on the shoulders of men and women in various ways.
Well, you wonder if the private contractors are doing any of the kind of work that you're talking about in terms of preparing your men. It certainly didn't, from the impression of this one home video that a private contractor made.
Well, I've been at conferences and have heard presentations from the major contracting group in Britain, and the claim was, in a presentation at a well-known military think tank, that they are letting them know in advance of the same sorts of principles of just conduct and procedures in Geneva Code, et cetera, Geneva Conventions, as uniformed troops fight with. But, you know, and many have been service people before. There are a lot of retired uniformed people that are now private contractors. But there are also many out there for money and adventure, soldiers of fortune. And it's much less regulated in terms of leadership echelons, hierarchical ranking, and punishment.
Yeah.
The exposés in the news recently give us an indication of that.
We just have about 2 minutes here. I want to thank the last caller and want to make sure I include one more here, someone listening in Terre Haute, Indiana, on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question in terms of immediacy to the situation, and that is, as in Vietnam, where we were doing blanket bombing, and here in Afghanistan, we did carpet bombing. We tried to win the war with technology using MX missiles. How does this affect folks who are actually controlling the guided bombs and the pilots that are flying the aircraft from 30, 40, 50,000 feet, so that they're not immediately adjacent to the task at hand, but their impact is just as great? Do they have a
very interesting question? I'll quote a colonel who teaches ethics at the Naval Academy, Marine Colonel, and who is a pilot, and I was interviewing him with five other colonels, but who were infantry, and he said, "We don't carry the emotional baggage you carry, but the responsibility is still on our shoulders." So they're morally responsible and accountable, especially the target guy. I mean, they work hard at their targeting, but they don't see it, feel it. They're not at a checkpoint up close shooting when a kid dies who may or may not have had been strapped with a IED around his waist. So they're morally accountable, but they don't always feel the same emotional impact. And that has to do, as you say, with proximity and distance.
Well, again, I wanted to thank the caller. We're coming to the point here where we have to finish in about a minute or two. And I'm not even really quite sure if it's possible to have some ending point here that actually brings us some closer to the subject, because I'm not sure that that's possible.
Well, I guess I would just like to close on the thought that Stoicism and a kind of Stoic warrior ethos mm-hmm. is very protective and it's very appealing. It has its pernicious side effects, and one of them is it's hard to let go of the thought that you're invincible, or that you at least can be tough and tough it out in war. And we need to remember, I think, what Seneca said: "Let us cultivate humanity." As Stoics, we need to have a softer, gentler kind of Stoicism. I think it's possible with more empathy toward ourselves and others when we're in war, come home wounded, and live with war. My dad's 86 and still living with World War II, and many will be living with war for the rest of their lives. As a society, we need to better understand the ambivalence of all the emotions that come home from war.
And I guess I can see that it might be possible and might be beneficial to cultivate what you refer to as a gentler kind of Stoicism in your life if you're just a regular person. I guess I'm still wondering how it is that you whether one could actually go onto the battlefield and do the jobs we ask soldiers to do if you didn't feel. I mean, I'm
you
sure if you
can feel. It, you need to feel a certain amount. Adrenaline does a lot. you get over certain kinds of fears. You certainly always some feel a lot of fear, but you certainly have a kind of revved up feeling. Nature dissociates for you. Dissociation is something that happens physiologically. You depersonalize. It wasn't me there. It was someone else. I didn't lose my leg. Someone else did. That's a kind of numbing effect. It's being given permission afterwards to let it go and to have the social, medical, psychiatric, and public support to recognize that. Coriolanus, Shakespeare's great Stoic warrior in the play, said, "It is no small things for mine eyes to sweat tears," something to that effect. That's amazing. And I think a lot of soldiers need to say that to themselves and their loved ones, too, and the military bureaucracy that handles all the hurdles of paperwork and paper pushing that makes them better and reintegrated into society afterwards.
Well, we're going to have to stop here. Our guest, Nancy Sherman, is professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. She served from 1997 until 1999 as the first distinguished chair of ethics at the U.S. Naval Academy and continues to serve as a consultant to the Navy and the Naval Academy and has done many interviews on this very subject on military ethics. You might want to look at her book, Stoic Warriors, The Ancient Philosophy Behind the Military Mind. Oxford is the publisher. And then coming soon from Norton, The War Within, maybe sometime next year.
Yes, that's right.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.